Hello, and welcome back to the Hi-Ho Podcast. My name's Victoria Sundin.
And I'm David Westbrook.
And this is Have You Heard Of? So, David.
So, Victoria.
Do you know who we're talking about today? In reference to the last episode we had?
I mean, do I know who we're talking about today? Yes, I do know who we're talking about today, because we communally agreed upon who we would be talking about. But
that's a good point. That's half the battle.
It's half the battle is figuring out who to talk about. But I don't know anything about this man besides the fact that we talked about his son.
So today we are talking about Samuel Wesley. Have you heard of Samuel Wesley?
I have not heard of Samuel Wesley. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know anything about this man.
Well, you obviously know the Wesleys, as we
I know his dad.
Briefly. Yes, his dad is very famous. That's Charles Wesley, famous hymn writer slash founder of the Methodist Church.
Little important.
Went around here and there, spreading the
he
good
word. He traveled
a
lot.
Mm-hmm. Traveled to the Americas, which is
I know
a lot
that's a big deal back then.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so we talked about his son in our last episode, Samuel Sebastian Wesley, mm-hmm. and I mentioned how Samuel Wesley was regarded as the English Mozart of his time.
Yes,
and so today we're going to expand on that a little bit. So awesome. Samuel Wesley was an English organist and composer, and he was born on February 24th. In 1766 in Bristol, Southwest England.
Oh, wow. His mm-hmm. birthday is tomorrow.
Hey, happy birthday.
Hey, happy birthday.
His parents were Charles Wesley and Sarah Wesley. Charles Wesley, again, being the famous hymn writer.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned in the last episode, they came from a very spiritual, very Christian family.
And I would assume so.
Yes, so Samuel already grew up in that environment, as did Samuel Sebastian,
okay.
Because the legacy is pretty important back in the day.
Yes.
So Samuel Wesley's musical training started at home. His mother would play the harpsichord and sing, like, family, like hymns, mm-hmm. and, like, favorite family songs.
Yeah.
Throughout the family, so that's how he was first introduced to music, and that's how he first started learning music as well.
Interesting. Well, I mean, we know that the Wesleys didn't do anything for music.
nope.
Hymns? A+. Tunes? F-.
Not a one. This might be a stretch, but I want to say that Samuel Wesley is the first Wesley to actually, like, be a composer, unless Charles Wesley had a brother or something like that that was a composer. I really don't know about any
I haven't heard of any other of the, like, Wesleys of that generation.
Mm-hmm.
I've never
choir
heard
director,
of... Yeah,
correct
choir
us
director,
if we're wrong.
Hit us up.
But Samuel also took organ lessons from a man named David Williams, who was the organist at the All Saints Church in Bristol,
mm-hmm.
and he was quickly recognized as a child prodigy in the organ.
Nice,
he mastered playing the organ as well as the harpsichord and the violin.
Oh, cool.
The trifecta. That's the... Mm. You know how nowadays there's like the triple threat,
mm-hmm.
with singing, dancing, and acting? Well, that was the triple threat back then. Organ,
dang.
Harpsichord, and violin.
Dang. See? Bach wasn't even a triple threat. Bach might have played... I don't know if Bach played the violin. I don't think he did. I never heard anything about him playing the violin. He probably played the violin, though.
Probably, I don't know.
Probably. I know Mozart did. I know Beethoven did.
Hmm, catch up.
Hmm. Sorry, Bach.
Get good. in 1778, the Wesleys moved to London. We've actually been to their house in London.
We have been to his house.
The Wesley Church that was next to their house in London on a choir tour. It's a really pretty house, yeah.
It was very pretty, yeah.
But in 1793, at the age of 27, Samuel married Charlotte Wesley.
Mm-hmm.
Without any official ceremony, they just kind of eloped. Ooh. That was really controversial back in the day.
Spicy.
Mm-hmm. And they had 3 children together.
Mm-hmm.
But this marriage sadly fell apart after Charlotte discovered that Samuel was having an affair with their house servant, Sarah Suter.
Mm.
And those two never married, but they did have four children together, one of them being Samuel Sebastian, that we talked about already. And as if this man's life wasn't controversial enough, in 1784, he secretly converted to Catholicism.
Dang, what a slap in the face to his dad.
Yeah.
Imagine, like, founding your own, like, sect of Christianity that's, like, picking up steam and your son doesn't even want to be a part of it.
Mm-mm. That's like...
And he went, like, OG, too, if he was going all the way to Catholicism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Going way back.
Samuel.
That's like having a family shoe factory and your son doesn't want to be a shoe salesman.
God, and your son's just a barefoot hippie.
But yeah, his father and his uncle, John Wesley, were very upset. And his father wrote these poetic words about this scandal. He said, or he wrote, rather, "While ready and resolved is he to plunge into the dark abyss and cast his soul away, that poison of the Romish sect, oh, let not his soul infect."
God. That's rough.
Yep.
This poor man. Poor. He doesn't deserve this.
Well.
Yeah, he kind of deserves it a little bit, but...
So, despite this, he celebrated his conversion to Catholicism by writing his Missa di Spiritu Sancto, which was dedicated to Pope Pius VI.
Okay. So, Mass of the Holy Spirit?
Yeah.
Nice, nice.
Wow, he speaks Latin, too.
I know my Latin, what can I say?
In 1788, Wesley was initiated into Freemasonry. Woo!
Woo!
And the Duke of Sussex appointed him as the Grand Organist of the Premier Grand Lodge of England, which was, like, one of the Freemasonry lodges, in 1812, and he continued in office through the process of Masonic unification in 1813. He was the Grand Organist at the lodge for 5 years, but stepped down in 1818. He worked as a conductor, a music teacher, and a lecturer throughout most of his life. And some historians say that he was, like, the pioneer of organ concerts.
Oh, cool.
Because back in the day, it wasn't really appropriate to play music for entertainment in the church. And so he, I guess, gave a lot of organ concerts in the church, which kind of set the standard of those to this day.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
I've never really thought about that because, I mean, that makes sense, though, that you wouldn't give, like, an organ concert in a church. Because that's not what that space is designed for.
Nowadays, it's just, like, a community theater. There was no church community theater back in the day.
No, there wasn't. There wasn't. Nobody was doing Godspell in Notre Dame.
He was considered to be the best organ improviser of the time, and historians even called him the English Mozart. They were contemporaries. I don't think they ever met each other, but they were alive and actively composing during the same time period. I think he's like 10 years younger than Mozart. Yeah, yeah, because Mozart was born in 1756, and he was born 10 years later. So yeah, so that's a cool little nickname.
Yeah. That's a good nickname to have. It's always weird that, like, all of those composers, whenever they're good at something, they're always just, like, the blank Mozart. I don't like that. Why can't they be, like, the...
Why do they need that comparison to, like...
Yeah, I mean, Mozart was great, but I wouldn't call him the best composer of all time.
No, absolutely not.
No.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Don't like
Even, like, the Chevalier we talked about in the first episode, he was known as the Black Mozart. Like,
And I guess...
First off, you shouldn't be comparing a black man to a white man.
No, definitely not.
It's very different, like, cultural upbringings, and, like, we shouldn't erase black people like that by comparing them to white people.
Yeah.
That's a story for another time, though.
Definitely, definitely. And, I mean, I guess in these cases it kind of makes sense because they're both, like, in the same time period, you know, and they're both composing in the same style and all of that. Not saying that, like, the Chevalier should be compared to Mozart or anything like that, but, I mean, as far as, like, the time period goes, you know, but even people nowadays, you know, they'll be like, oh, he's the modern Mozart or whatever. It's like,
minimalist
there's nothing
Mozart.
Similar. between Mozart and this man.
Nothing minimalist about Mozart.
No. No. It'd be like if someone was like, Arvo Pärt is the modern day Mozart. Like, Arvo Pärt is not the modern day Mozart. Arvo Pärt is the modern day Arvo Pärt.
Yes. Yes. Mozart is canceled.
Mm. I'm fine with that.
But anyway, despite this success, despite being called the English Mozart, Samuel Wesley had a hard time finding a job as, like an organist for churches, for different organizations.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't get the job as the organist for the Founding Hospital in 1798, and when he tried again in 1813. And he also didn't land the job at the St. George's Hanover Square Church in 1824. And he was seen as unreliable and was distrusted by the British government because he eloped. He never, like, officially got married. And mm-hmm. so the government's like, we don't trust this man. So from 1815 onwards, he states that he began a battle with depression.
Oh no.
Mm-hmm.
My poor dude.
Yeah. Normalize mental health in the classical music world.
Yeah, in the 1700s.
Mm-hmm. But despite all of this, he was so good at the organ that he was introduced to and performed for a Felix Mendelssohn in September of 1837.
Ooh, fancy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mendelssohn was giving a recital at the Christ Church in London, where Samuel was present. And at this point, Samuel Wesley is like a frail old man. Mm-hmm. You know, doesn't really compose anymore, doesn't really play the organ or the harpsichord or the violin, I guess, anymore. Mm-hmm. So Mendelssohn invites Samuel Wesley onto the stage and was like, play the organ, play something. And Samuel said something like, oh, I'm not as good as I used to be, but apparently Mendelssohn was still pretty impressed with his playing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It's often it's like, as those people get old, I mean, they lose some of their ability, but they're never like, it feels like those people that are really good never truly get bad, mm-hmm. you know? Like,
yeah, there are some TikToks of like people filming like their grandmother who used to be like concert pianists, like playing the piano, and they're still like really good at the piano.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, well, there's an excellent video of Horowitz as like an old man playing a Scriabin piece called Vers la Flamme, which is hard as nails to play. And I mean, and of course, classic Horowitz, you know, there's some parts that are definitely sus, as far as if he's playing the right notes, but that's always how Horowitz was.
Mm-hmm.
But he still had it.
Yeah, see? It's all muscle memory.
Mm-hmm.
I could probably still play the New World Symphony that I learned when I was 10 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, once you got
like an abridged version of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, with this happy memory now in his mind and in his heart, a month later, Samuel Wesley dies on October 11th, 1873, at the age of 71 in London.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, let's talk about his compositions and his music for a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
At some point between 1818 and his death, Samuel became acquainted with the works of J.S. Bach. As mm-hmm. we mentioned in the last episode, he named Samuel Sebastian after Bach because, you know, Sebastian was Bach's middle name. And he released a joint publication with a German-English composer, Charles Frederick Horn, that popularized Bach's work in England.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's pretty neat. He's like the English version. He's the English Mendelssohn in that regard.
There we go. That's what I like to hear.
Mm-hmm. So most of his compositions were written for the church.
Mm-hmm.
But he did write some secular pieces, mainly madrigals.
Yeah, I stumbled upon some of those.
Mm-hmm. Madrigals, again, are like secular works written for the church in the polyphonic style, or mm-hmm. at least for the Renaissance period, that is. But anyway, his most notable secular piece was a five-part madrigal called O Sing Unto Me Roundelay. It's written in, like, old-timey English, so I'm doing mm-hmm. my best to read it.
I got no clue.
Yeah. Much of his works that were published at the time were mostly forgotten, mm-hmm. and so actual copies of these works are rare and mostly unavailable for, like, modern performances.
Mm-hmm.
And a considerable amount of his work exists in, like, manuscript form only.
Yeah, because as I was looking for pieces to do, I know that he wrote a lot of stuff, but I could not find that much online of his actual pieces.
Yeah. It do be a secret. That's how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, he wrote about 120 organ pieces, 41 Latin motets, and the cantata Confiteor Tibi Domine, at least two masses, and his Missa de Spiritu Sancto that he wrote to commemorate his conversion to Catholicism, is scored for solo voices and chorus with strings, oboes, horns, trumpets, and drums.
Nice.
Which is, like, drums. A pretty sizable orchestration for that time period, I think, because this is, like, late classical, early romantic, and so that's when we really start to see orchestrations get really big.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the symphony had been pretty well established by that point.
Yeah, that's true.
No, maybe not. Not well, as much.
Haydn was, you know, Haydn has passed on at this point, I think.
Yeah, true.
But even, like, Mozart's early symphonies, they weren't scored for, like, super, super big orchestras.
Yeah, that is true. So I'm not quite sure. I don't really know the history of, like, when the symphony grew to the size that it did.
Mm-hmm.
There's always something more to know about music.
Speaking of symphonies, he wrote six and four orchestral overture-type works.
Mm-hmm.
Which, like, this is really cool to see because, as we mentioned earlier, I think Samuel Wesley was the first Wesley to, like, actually be more of a composer than a hymn writer.
Mm-hmm.
Because Charles Wesley didn't write symphonies. Yeah. John Wesley didn't write symphonies. Like, that was not their wheelhouse. So it's really cool to see, that, like, a Wesley really dive into the world of composition.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that's pretty neat. And Samuel Sebastian did not do half as much as Samuel Wesley did. I think Samuel Sebastian wrote more for, like, the church.
Yeah, it seems like he wrote a lot more for, like, choir and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's what I mean. There we go.
Yeah, yeah. But Samuel Sebastian is definitely the one that stayed famous, though I think that's only because of Lead Me, Lord.
So, Wesley's compositional style was very eclectic, had some influences from late Baroque, you know, with Bach, had influences from the classical era, and later the early Romantic era.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, that's all I have on our good friend Samuel Wesley.
Nice. It sounds like he definitely lived a weird life, at the very least.
Mm-hmm. Controversial.
Controversial, yeah.
Hmm. All right.
Alrighty. Let's move on to his music.
Yeah.
So, we're only going to listen to one piece, because it's kind of longer, and it actually includes three pieces, technically. So, this is Samuel Wesley. This is one of the church services that he composed a piece for choir. Mm-hmm. So, since this is a church service, there's a whole bunch of different sections of it. So, this is for a Catholic service. What we're going to be listening to today is we're going to be listening to the Longer Jubilate Deo. And then we're also going to listen to a shorter Kyrie and a shorter Sanctus.
Nice.
Yes. So, as I mentioned, the first one that we're going to listen to is the Jubilate Deo. This would normally be for choir, but I decided that it's easier to listen to and hear all the voices moving if I just had the recording be on piano instead. The first sentence of the Jubilate Deo, just to get you an idea of it, says, "O be joyful in the Lord, all ye lands, serve the Lord. Serve the Lord with gladness and come before his presence with a song."
Nice.
That kind of sets the stage of what this text is about.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty, let's give it a listen.
Yeah, let's give her a listen. Yeah, for someone who was a Bach simp, there's a lot of parallel movement going on right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this definitely is giving me bigger, like, Martin Luther feel.
Yeah.
Though Bach also wrote a lot of chorales.
Yeah, what's ironic is he's Catholic. Alright, we got a little quiet section right here. Yeah, there was some good text painting in that last part we listened to. Because it is a declamatory statement, and so everyone's singing on the same beat. There's not that much counterpoint going on. And it's emphasizing the text, and so we get a good contrast here with the quieter section. Yeah, we start to get some counterpoint here.
Even his sections of counterpoint are very fleeting throughout this.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
You'll hear in a second. Because he's setting up this canon right here.
Yeah. Now that is very Bach. The man did like canons and fugues. Mm-hmm.
This is very much so arranged by slow sections like this that are very polyphonic, right? Mixed with those quicker, more fugal, canonical sections.
Mm-hmm. Do you mean homophonic?
Homophonic, no, yeah.
I mean, it is polyphonic because there are multiple voices singing. So, that's a lot of terms.
They all sound the same, too.
Yeah, you get the idea.
And now we get into the Glory Be to the Father and to the Son part.
I like that he changed up the rhythm a little bit.
Yes.
This, in masses, this is normally like a part that gets repeated throughout the entire piece, because especially in like the Sanctus and then Benedictus, it always ends with like Glory be to the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, etc., etc. So I'm excited to see what he does with this text in relation to the entire piece. Nice, we get octaves, the ending.
So that was the Jubilati Deo section. One thing I wanted to talk about quickly is that really weird final chord change he does.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going from a C minor chord to an F major chord to end it, so like a minor 5-1.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not something that you would normally see.
Yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
I just think it's interesting. It's not a chord progression, especially in this time period, that I would associate with doing that. And it feels outside the box. And even nowadays, it feels weird to go from that minor 5 chord to that 1 to end it.
Mm-hmm. And I like that moving part that the tenors have, that modulate from that minor 5 back to the 1.
Yeah. Yeah, it is really good.
Mm-hmm. So he, he made a choice, stuck to it, and then was able to, like, resolve it in a way that doesn't sound too jarring, but interesting enough to not bore us to death.
Mm-hmm.
Good job, Wesley.
Good job. Okay. The next piece is the Sanctus. Very, very well-known text. Holy, 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 Lord God of hosts, heaven and earth are full of your glory. Glory be to thee, O Lord Most High. Is one translation of it.
Oh, I guess that would be the glory be to the Lord. Because usually there are, like, hosannas in the Sanctus, right?
I'm just reading the text off of what this one has. I assume it's also just a translation difference, you know? Because there's 5,000 different ways that the Mass is translated, it seems like.
That's true.
And I assume that is how they had it translated back then.
All right. That was just like a minor observation. There's really nothing to do with this. So, sorry for getting off track for a second. All right, I'm ready.
Alrighty.
Do you know who wrote the holy, holy, holy Lord? Mm-hmm. Do you know who wrote that?
No.
Tune. Well, it wouldn't make a difference because the Wesleys didn't write hymn tunes. I was going to say, like, that might be a reference to that, but I really don't know, like, the age of that hymn tune. I would have to do more research on that. But all of that is to say it starts off like a... it starts off in a familiar way to especially us nowadays.
I really like this piece. I really like it. It's short and simple, but there's some really interesting chords that he uses. I don't know if you picked up on any of them.
Yeah, those are some interesting chords, especially at the end when it goes from like a B flat major, I guess.
Yeah, that like B flat 7.
Yeah, to C and then to F.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's knots that he's using, or like conventional chord progressions.
Yeah, I like the so the high part that we got to where it gets much louder is the heaven and earth are full of thy glory, right? So there's good text painting, right? Because he's talking about like the fullness of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
With this really loud chord.
Yes.
Yeah. And then it gets really funky around, like, the glory be to thee, O Lord Most High. That's where those chords really get fresh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a good mix of homophonic moments where they're all singing the same rhythm and some contrapuntal moments where they're all singing over each other and, like, overlapping lines.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, to see that the altos actually get their moment to shine as the main, like, leader of that harmonic progression.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have some of the really juicy notes.
They do get those juicy notes. Yeah, that alludes back to the ending of the Jubilate. Because the tenors have their little moving moment, and now mm-hmm. the altos have their moving moment. So I guess that's just a way that Samuel Wesley liked to end his pieces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with kind of that, like, downward scalar motion. Yeah, for sure. Alright, and we have one other piece that we're going to listen to from this. This is the Kyrie Eleison. So, I'm a little bit interested in the text that they have here. So, the typical Kyrie text is just like, Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy, Lord mm-hmm. have mercy. But here the text reads, Lord have mercy upon us and incline our hearts to keep this law. Lord have mercy upon us and write all these. by laws in our hearts, we beseech thee.
I mean, I don't know anything about Catholic masses, and so do they have, like, a... Is there a prayer that's associated with the Kyrie that this is just a translation of? Or do they just chant Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison, Kyrie eleison?
Yeah, so... This Kyrie might be a more substantiated prayer for maybe, like, an evensong.
Okay.
Service or something like that. I'm not quite sure. Evening Mass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Either way, though. Let's go to listen.
Mm-hmm. Nice. That was like a... Well, he didn't use any scalar movement to end the piece this time, but that feels like a sort of incomplete way to end it, which is just like a slight movement within the entire service itself, so there doesn't need to be like a big ol' like plagal cadence amen going on, but yeah, it's refreshing and different from the previous ways that
has ended. And the next piece that comes up in the service after this would be the Magnificat anyway, which is a very substantial text.
Yes, quite large.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's really pretty. I could not, I don't think that there are any actual recordings of this that exist.
Mm-hmm.
At least I couldn't find any from the research that I did. But I do think that it's very, I think it's interesting just to see how he takes these texts and uses them. You can definitely tell kind of the early Baroque Protestant feeling to some of these more chorale sections.
He's bringing that sort of flair within the Catholic scene, because music in the Catholic Church at this point, although, like, we are, introducing organ and, like, instruments into Catholic music, or, like, we're beginning to, it's all very, like, chanty still. It's very polyphonic. Lots of moving counterpoint. Mm-hmm. And so this is sort of where we begin to see, like, this type of music within the Catholic Church.
Yeah. And if you want a recording of him... If you want to hear a piece of Samuel Wesley's that is a lot more engaging, that is a lot more, like, virtuosic in its compositional style, there's a piece he wrote that there are recordings that exist, that's called In Exi to Israel.
Okay.
That piece, Victoria and I have listened to it before together, and it is... super fugal. It's for double choir.
For sure.
It's a really good piece.
Yeah, that sounds more of what you would assume Catholic choral music to sound like.
Yeah. Yeah, I would highly recommend giving it a listen.
It is very good.
Yeah. But all in all, I really do like his stuff. I think it's interesting.
Yeah, he's a smart composer. There's good text painting. There's, which is good for church settings, because you're there to focus on the word of God and not so much the music. Yes. So, didn't ruffle any feathers in the church. And it's interesting to see now that we just talked about it, like, his blend of what he grew up with and the music that, he, like, grew up singing at home with his Methodist parents. Yeah. But in the context of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. You can definitely see all the different influences that are working on him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yeah. I think if you wanted to write a, if you're like listening to this and you need a paper to write for your music history class, like I think this would be an interesting topic of incorporating more new world type church music into old world church music.
Yeah, definitely. I think he does do a solid blend of the two.
Yeah. Dare I say he's the first one to do so?
Maybe.
Maybe. Maybe I'm just forgetting everyone right now. Alright, well that's some good stuff.
That's some good stuff, yeah. I'm glad that we got a chance to talk about him.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Well, thank you for tuning into this week's episode of the Hi-Ho Podcast. If you want to keep up with us on social media, you can follow us on Instagram at Hi-Ho Podcast. And if you want to shoot us an email with recommendations of composers we should talk about or any observations you made from the music we listened to, you can email us at thehihopodcast@gmail.com. Please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, and we will see you in our next episode. Bye!
Bye!